Welcome to this podcast of the European Survey Research Association. My name is Vera Tupul, and today we have a podcast about smart surveys collecting digital trace data. And with me are two guests, Mark Trapman and Barry Schouten. Mark Trapman is the head of the research department panel study labor market and social security at the Institute for Employment Research in Nuremberg and professor for survey methodology at the University of Bamberg. And in his research, he investigates error sources in surveys and in digital trace data. Welcome, Mark.
Yeah, thank you, Vera. I'm glad to be here.
And yes, thank you so much. And my other guest is Barry Schouten. He's a senior methodologist at Statistics Netherlands, where he does a lot about what we call in official statistics smart surveys. Doing a lot of international projects as well. And he's also professor at the Department of Methods and Statistics at Utrecht University. Welcome, Barry.
Thanks. Thanks for inviting me.
So maybe first question, Mark. So what is the definition of digital trace data?
Well, I would say that digital trace data are the data that are produced inevitably when people use devices in everyday life, like smartphones, computers, the internet, wearables, for example. And well, in a way, these data are found or organic data in the sense that they were not designed for research, but we have to take them as they are. So while they usually are highly granular, and that may have a high potential for research, we have to accept the data quality as we find it. Unlike in surveys where we put a lot of effort into designing a study from the beginning, such as to minimize total survey error.
Thanks. And Barry, I know you talk a lot about smart surveys. So what is the definition of a smart survey, and is that the same as digital trace data?
Well, it's in a way it's the same, but we never use the term digital trace data for two reasons. I think one reason is that we also try respondents to create the data. So it's not just waiting for the data to be there and to ask it, but also invite them to create them, so sort of more proactively, you would say. And the second reason is that the term trace in official statistics is a bit of an impacted term. So over the last few years, statistical institutes had few issues with public image. You know, mobile telephone data was a big fuss about that, and the term digital trace had a bad connotation, I think, but that's why they don't like to use it. But yeah, the term smart surveys itself actually was thought up by Eurostat some years ago. They always think about smart statistics, and the leap to smart surveys wasn't very big, I guess. And it gets its name from using smart devices. That's basically it. Yeah.
But I think that makes absolute sense, Bali, because that's so combining these data collections with surveys, in a sense, enables us to bring design back in to these data and not to accept them as they are, but to get interpretations and to design the samples and so on.
Yes, for sure. I think that, but we'll probably come back to that later, but maybe the most challenging part in these kind of surveys is what kind of active role we still need from the respondents in surveys. So what validation, what supplemental context we need, and how to present them. But that definitely is a specific part where we spend a lot of attention.
Yeah, so maybe, Mark, I know you have done a lot with digital trace data. Can you tell us a little bit more about the projects that you have been working on?
Yeah, well, I think I can tell you about the major study we did. And that was quite a large scale project that we began in 2018, and we collected the data in 2018. And that was also such a combination of a designed survey with a digital trace data collection. So we have this long-running panel survey for labor market research in Germany called the PAS panel, and that has been running since 2007. And in the 2017 wave, we asked respondents whether they had a smartphone and which operating system they used. And based on this information, just after the 2017 wave, we invited them to install the research app, the IAB Smart app, on their smartphones. So we invited the past participants to install this research app, the IAB Smart app, on their smartphones. And we targeted this invitation at those who had responded that they owned an Android smartphone. So we focused on Android because it's very difficult to produce an app for different system, and iOS also doesn't allow a lot of stuff that Android allows third parties who produce apps. Also we found, I mean, that was why we asked these questions before, so we could separate coverage error from non-response error. And we found out that while Android users are not so much different from the general population, iOS users are very different. So we decided to focus on Android. And so our goal was to have a very extensive 6 months observation of people. And our survey focuses on unemployed a lot. And there has been a groundbreaking study that many psychologists and sociologists know in the 1930s, the Marienthal study, that we took as an example where collecting survey data was combined with other techniques like observations, qualitative interviews, and so on. And a lot of data of different kind was put together to describe the situation of people who had become unemployed in the town of Marienthal after a factory closed down. And we thought this very comprising observation of different aspects of their life, this is something that can be done with smartphones nowadays. So we asked people to agree on top of doing surveys with the app. We could, for example, do surveys that we targeted by locations that people visited, like job centers where they have to report and where they get information on jobs. But we also asked them to agree to us collecting 5 kinds of data, and It took a lot of effort to get everything into accordance with GDPR, General Data Protection Regulation. So people had to agree separately to each of the functions, which means there are not only respondents and non-respondents, but also respondents who participated in some of the data collections and not in others. And also all respondents had the option to withdraw any time, and it has to be as easy as giving consent to withdraw consent. That's also in the spirit of the GDPR. And the 5 functions were location data, so that's basically GPS or other kinds of getting the location, communication data, which is, for example, incoming, outgoing calls, then social network data from the address book, activity data, which is from sensors built into the smartphone, and smartphone usage. So, for example, when are which apps opened and closed. And we invited about 4,000 panel participants, and 600 agreed to and installed the app and became participants in our study. And we observed them for about half a year, and still, the amount of data that we got and the task to process these data and to understand these data is so large that we are still working on with these data we collected in 2018.
So does that also require different skills for analyzing this type of data?
Well, definitely. So the size of the data sets is so big that we found we couldn't handle them well with data. So other software is probably more useful. So we used R, for example. But also we found that like finding patterns in these vast data sets, it's probably something that machine learning techniques or machine learning methods can be very useful. We found that we use that a lot. But these are general trends, I would say, in the social sciences anyway.
Yeah, exactly. So Barry, what is your experience with smart surveys?
Well, you know, although I work at Utrecht University, I'm primarily a official statistics methodologist, you could say. So Statistical Institute, I think, a little different. So they don't think data-driven. They think in terms of what is the need from ministries and other government parties, right? So they have a program. They have certain surveys or topics that they have to sort of observe. So what we did is we started in 2017. I think it was 2017, talking to a lot of statistical departments. What are the surveys in need? Where are the issues? What surveys have very low response rates? They seem to be burdensome to respondents, or the questionnaire by itself is actually not a very good concept. You know, if we start to think about the indoor living conditions, it's very hard to ask that in terms of questions to a person. Well, anyway, at the time we came to sort of six topics, maybe more or less six themes, as we call them. Each of them is related to at least one or maybe multiple surveys, and many of them actually in European context. So there's always a European dimension to it. So we started working on the most obvious one, I guess, was always travel and mobility. So this was already made mention, location data. We started on expenditures, what people buy and where and how. Media and time use. So what people do in their time, especially media use, can be leaning on the same kind of data that Mark was mentioning, you know, if you're restricted to your smartphone, obviously. Physical activity. So that's where we started to use wearables. Living conditions, where we have sort of systems that you can call in your house and they measure all kinds of parameters from particulate matter to CO2, you know, it's broad range of parameters, and living condition, working conditions. So what people are exposed to on work, especially when it comes to sound and light, and again, certain kinds of bad air quality, you know, these kind of things. And I think then we started to work with the two projects that we thought were the easiest. If looking back, that is not true. But anyway, we did thought at the time. So we started working on a mobility app, which is now exists. You can find it in the app stores, and a budget survey app, which is also in app stores right now. And both of them have been quite extensively tested in bigger samples, also internationally. So this budget app is now, I think, now available in something like 12 countries or so. And we build it ourselves. Maybe that's interesting to mention. There's a lot of reasons against that, but we fought for the reasons of transparency and control. So we want to be in control what we ask for from respondents and how we interact with them. We always have interviewers in these studies, so we can interact with the interviewers as well if needed. We thought that would be a strong advantage to do it ourselves. Also, cross-platform, which has its issues, as Mark already mentioned. So iOS is quite different. But anyway, that's where we are right now. So we have a few apps in the field and some studies that are a little bit more exotic. So wearables and sensor systems and all that. Yeah.
And do you use these apps in addition to the regular survey, or are they used as a replacement?
They are designed to be a replacement for the original survey. So the travel app and the budget app should, at least to some extent, replace the original way of working. But I have to say immediately that we know that not everyone likes to go smart. So we still think that at least part of the population would have to go through other modes, as you may call it. especially for budget survey, that is true. You know, it's you add quite a lot of information from households, what they spend and so on. So we are still trying to find out what is the right push to smart strategy, as we call it. So first try to go smart, and if not, it doesn't work. How can we go to other modes without losing comparability? That's, of course, a big issue in all of these things. So, yeah.
But Barry, how does that then relate to costs? Does using a smart survey, is that an increase in cost or a reduction?
Yeah, I think it depends a little bit on the project budget anyway. You know, for example, household budget survey gives 30 euros incentive to households. That's a relatively high amount. We can work with that. But the travel survey, at least in the Netherlands, only has a lottery. That's the only incentive they give. So we don't have a lot of a space to move with that budget in the field. But I think you also need to make a distinction between the implementation, investment, you know, getting this infrastructure ready, the logistics, all of that, versus the actual field cost once it's ready. And I would say the investment is quite considerable if you want to do it right and you want to have the good case management and all that. The field cost, you know, once you have it, I think they are comparable to the original surveys because, for example, for travel and budget, we also increased the reporting period. So for travel, we went from 1 day to 7 days. And we've learned that we had almost sort of three times as much information coming out of this week than we had from 1 day. So we can decrease the samples because of that. But the investment is definitely something not to take lightly.
Yeah. And I imagine not only in terms of cost, but also in terms of time, because it takes time to develop an app, right?
Yeah, it takes time to develop an app, but this is also something that really has a learning curve. So if you do this as a statistical institute yourself, you make a lot of mistakes at first. You know, the user interface by itself, you know, what is actually the easy part. It's not so hard, but it's the everything that's underneath it, the sender data stuff, how do it in a legal, properly way, how to process it, maybe in real time, and to present it. That's really the hard stuff that can take a few years to get it right. Yeah. Definitely.
So Mark, if you would summarize, what would be the pros and cons of using digital trace data in comparison to a regular survey?
Oh, well, that's not easy to answer this one. Well, because there's so many different aspects, and it depends so much on what you want to collect data on. I mean, we have several issues where we have limitations in how we can ask people details they can report about it. And a lot of these examples, to the examples that Barry gave, like expenditures or mobility, no one can recall all this stuff in a survey. And of course, in these areas, having digital trace data can be a big advantage, while in others, maybe it doesn't. But so depending on the subject of your research, you have to weigh the costs and the benefits. I think it's very hard to give an overall answer to that. And related to costs, there are certain components that you save money on, like, for example, you don't need any interviewers, but other components that you have to spend money on, like we found it very, we were surprised how much effort we would have to put into post-collection processing of the digital trace data. So that was really, we didn't expect that it would take us so long to understand these data. I think a good example is the location data, where we found after we collected them, we found that 54% of all scheduled location data were missing. And this, of course, this is, as a trained survey methodologist, you know that this is something you can't just ignore. But we looked into it. And then you find so many different reasons for the missingness. It can be due to people didn't give the permission to collect these data. It can be the device was switched off at the time. The device could be in doze mode, or there could be no signal at the moment. There could be no GPS tower near, or it could be low battery, and then the app doesn't collect the data anymore. But then there's also such nice things. We learned that in few cases, like GPS faker apps that give you, that scramble the coordinates in a way. So you get a wrong position. And also there's an issue we found in the survey we did, that people share devices. It's also not so very common anymore. But so you have all these things to deal with and I think it's very important to differentiate between these different kinds of missingness, as important as to differentiate between does not apply and don't know in a survey, because it means completely different things. And, like for every data package that we got, we have to invest this work before we can work with the data. And that's really a lot. We underestimated the amount of work it takes.
And how is that for you, Barry, when it comes to validity and reliability?
Well, it's a recognizable story, of course. I think that, you know, if you look at this sort of smart data, you find it the same kinds of errors like in the survey, but in a bit different. So again, the whole representation, you can have missing data, but also the concepts change. People may not use the sensors properly. There might be processing errors, so, you know, we get part of the data coming in and so on. And most of this requires quite a bit of data science in its broader sense, all the way from thinking of decision rules that handle missing data or implausible location points to machine learning that predicts the transport mode, or in case of the budget survey, that tries to predict what is the product on your receipt, for example, your ticket. And I think there's basically sort of two gaps here. One is the gap between the, let's say, whether if it's perfect, what you actually want and what you get. So let's say the perfect sensor data versus the one data that you're actually looking for. And there's a gap between perfect sensor data and the actual real survey sensor data, which is also not to underestimate. So for location tracking, I think we worked for 2 years on getting that stable. In a sense that the app is not pushed away by the phone, and it's this doze mode that Mark was referring to. So in terms of battery usage, the frequency of measuring, all that, I think we found a solution, but we had to do that for every type of device, more or less, every operating system, Apple versus Android. So it's really a lot of work under the hood, you could say, that had to be done. So I think in all of these surveys, the machine learning is unavoidable, very, very important skill that we now need in order to get it right, to get to satisfactory validity, I guess.
And what is the role of the respondent? Do these apps reduce the response burden? And do they like to work with these innovative ways of data collection?
Well, the original motivation was, one of the main motivations was, of course, reduction of respondent burden. So if you can do location tracking, you don't have to report yourself where you've been the entire day, which is, many people don't like that very much, even if they would recall. These two gaps that I was just mentioning, the bigger they get, the more we need the respondent. Because the stronger we would have to rely on machine learning methods, which of course have their limits. We know you can't repair everything. So if the gap between actual sensor data and what you hoped for is very big, you need respondents to sort of fill these gaps. So people may not take their phone, they forgot the phone, they turned it off, they started using another phone, whatever. You need contact information about that. And it's, I think it's true for almost any of these surveys. And then you get the trade-off, how far can we push this new burden to them before losing them, that they break off or they satisfy it or whatever. So it's really learning where is that turning point, I think. Yeah, that's definitely true.
Yeah, let me add to that. I mean, the big advantage of digital trace data is that they are very reliable in the sense that they measure very exactly what they, well, the thing that they measure in the first place. So the location is measured. It depends a bit on where the location data, on the source of location data, but usually if it's GPS data, it's exact to like 10 meters or 5 meters. And no one would be able to recall across the whole day with this exactness where this person was, obviously. So this is a very high reliability of the measurement. And it would be a high validity if we were interested in GPS position itself. But we are not usually as social researchers interested in GPS position as such, but we derive measures from it. For example, time spent at home, or kilometers cycled on that day, or levels of activity and radius and so on. And when we derive these measures, we can make a lot of mistakes in the algorithms, the machine learning algorithms that Barry mentioned to extract this information, where is home, but also in interpreting the data. So, and here I think that surveys come in as a kind of validation data, very handy. So if we can ask people about the same construct that we try to measure with the digital trace data, that helps us to assess validity. And one example that I had to think of when Barry made his point was that we have differences in levels of activity between men and women that can partially be explained by women having their smartphone less often, carrying it on the body, and more often having it in a small bag, for example. So these differences in usage, so we need this information to make sense of the data. And so the data aren't always as valid when it gets to constructs, latent constructs. And this, I mean, this is for something easy, something very close to the measurement, like the daily activity. Often we use digital trace data as a substitute for for a latent construct that is even further away. Like, we have this long history of collecting social capital data in surveys, right? There's I don't know if it started with, but a very prominent example is the BERT name generator. So with whom do you discuss personal matters? And the number of people named is something like a measure of the core network. And then it took off from there, and survey research now has a lot of different questions to collect data on different dimensions or aspects of social capital. And now here we come with our digital trace data, and we take what is available, basically. And what do we have? We have an address book, and that has a certain size and number of entries. We have a number of outgoing calls and incoming calls. And of course, it seems like this could be plausible measures of social capital. Someone who has a lot of contacts is probably has more social capital than someone who has less contacts. But I think a lot of the research is yet to be done about the validity. So what kind of social capital is it that we map in the number of incoming or outgoing? So I think there's a lot of research being done at the moment, but also compared to survey research, we still know very little.
Yeah, can I just add one thing? Because, you know, burden is some one thing, but we are also very worried about the fact that we start to become too much of an intruder. So, you know, we are now sort of starting to collect data that the persons themselves also were not completely aware of. So if I go for indoor climate, people don't really know. So if we become too active in interacting with them, they start to become, they change the behavior. They start to open the window, or they, hey, my house is not so good as I thought. And you know, as a statistical substitute, we are observers. We are not interveners. So maybe academics, it's interesting to intervene and see, okay, do they really follow my suggestions? So that's also what we struggle with. We should try to remain a little bit on the background, but still have enough information back to understand the context, to sort of get it right. So that's also quite a tricky trade-off, I think.
Yeah, and for example, with using GPS, you know exactly where people live and where they go and where their kids go to school. So did you have any like more difficulty when it comes to ethics and privacy for getting your research done?
Well, shall I start? It took very careful consideration in advance and a lot of discussions with the data protection people at our institution to get these things right from the beginning. We have to be aware that this is very, very sensitive data that's potentially, you know, a lot of sensitive things about people, at least in the raw data. And of course, that also limits the way we can share this data. That's an important topic, I think. But In collecting data, we took a lot of effort into getting that into GDPR compliance. And for example, one very sensitive issue apart from location data is address book data, because here we're talking about data about third parties who did not consent to the data collection. So we came up with technical solutions, like we didn't get any names, but because we wanted to know something about nationalities and sex of the people in the address book, we found a way to classify that and only to get the classification results of hand them over to us. And so the same holds for telephone numbers. Of course, it's if you get to 50 incoming calls a day, it makes a difference whether it's 50 times the same person or 50 different persons. But you don't have to know the numbers. So we ended up hashing the telephone numbers so we can see whether it's the same person or not, but we don't know the exact numbers. And all this stuff we had to take care of before collecting the data.
Yeah, I think this is a new world for us. Especially survey designers, in the past, we did not have to talk too much to the legal departments, a little bit maybe when we sort of have the question, are we asking too much from respondents? Does this outweigh their effort, outweigh our utility? You know, this was sort of like a thing. But when we started in 2017 or so, the sun was bright. We didn't have a lot of issues, actually. We started to do a travel app study, no problems at all. And then I think when GDPR came, and especially when there were some public debates, you know, in the press and all that, legal departments became very cautious. And at some point we had a very strong discussion that everything that we collect should stay on the device of the respondent. Nothing can go out except the aggregate information that we need, which is a bit of a contradiction because the device of a respondent is much, much less safe than our own. That environment is much more robust to attackers, I would say. But anyway, but I think now with the event of in time, now it has changed a little bit. We legal officers are always part of the projects we do. So we in the European project, there is always one work package legal, and that's where the legal officers participate, and they start to learn. Okay, that's what they do. That's how they organize informed consent, because that's really an important issue all the time. And I think now we again have a little bit of leeway to go a little bit more toward the way we started out. So especially, well, you could say the data minimization principle. So that has changed a little bit. They now, and they also see that the quality of data can be such that if we would do all the processing locally, it would be so heavy on the device. The app would be so, have to be so big and powerful in a way that cannot be done. And you get potentially bad statistics if you do it that way. So, but it's a new world for sure. And then good to realize that statistical institutes, they care a lot about their public image. So they, even if it's GDPR compliant, if they think it's a bit tricky, that might be perceived that Big Brother or something like that, they stop. they don't go that way. So yeah, definitely a new world.
Yeah. So I think we're getting at the end of this podcast. So maybe an overall question for maybe young PhDs who are starting their research. What would be research topic that you think are important in the next couple of years when it comes to digital trace data?
Well, I think one obvious question we already talked about is the validity of the data, so there's probably a lot of research needed whether we can use certain kinds of digital trace data for latent constructs that are useful and important in social research. I think that's probably one thing where a lot of work can still be done. And then we have to be aware, I'm afraid, that we are shooting at a moving target. And a lot of research that has already been done has to be done again, I'm afraid. Because we cannot influence what the developers of the operating system, how they change the way that the data are collected, the way we can access them. So after we finished our IAB smart study, we had to find out that we couldn't have done it the same way again, because already so much has been changed in the way the operating system works and third party apps have to ask for permission and all this. So it's a world that is constantly changing. And I think it's an open question if research will ever catch up with these developments. That may, you may consider this good news for the young PhD researcher, for her or for him. It's probably good news because there's always open questions coming up.
Barry, do you want to add?
Yeah, I see sort of three main areas, and one relates very closely to what Mark was saying. One is in what I would call the push to smart strategy. How we're going to convey that we are doing here is not reducing burden, but it's also giving better quality. People respond to be in control if they want to, all that. We have to convey that message in a very short instance in letters or in an interviewer introduction. You know, it has to go very quick. That's a very complicated area, so the recruitment material and so on. Second, what I just talked about is respondent interaction, the role of the respondent, how far can we go with this, and where this is a validity question, I guess, but there are a lot of angles to it, from legal to quality to burden and all that. And I would say the third area is that relates close to what Mark was saying. If we train a machine learning model, then in 1-2 years time, it's outdated. It gives predictions that no longer are okay. So we estimated that our prediction of the product that we find on the receipt has a sort of accuracy performance of 85%, and after 1 year it was 70%. It dropped by 15% in 1 year. So you have to constantly keep up and follow that moving target that Mark was mentioning. And I think how to do that without losing variability is really a very statistical question. How to do this? Yeah, there's a lot of work to do. So I really invite people, young PhDs especially, to do this kind of research.
Yeah, but maybe let me add one thing that you didn't ask about, because it's certainly not a question for a PhD, young PhD students, but or they won't be able to solve it alone, but a very important question about digital trace data, I think, is about, let's call it governance of big data. So not only the question, how can we ethically or in a compliance with data protection rules collect these data, but also after we collected them, how can we share these data? How can we give equal access to this kind of data to all researchers? How can we share this data? How can we make sure that they are replicable? And I think there's a lot of questions that aren't solved yet, because the data are often so sensitive that they can't be shared and have to remain with the researchers who collected them. And so I think that's a huge area where we need, as like the institutions in our disciplines need to make progress in the upcoming years.
Enough work for us then. So thank you both for doing the podcast with me. This is actually the last in the first official series of the ESRA podcast. And we will look forward to seeing you at our next conference this year, and otherwise in the next series of podcasts. So thank you so much, and goodbye.
Thank you, Vera. Bye-bye, Barry.
Bye.